Bob, what really scares me about this scenario is just how close to tragedy we are at the moment where we're making this incredibly important decision. The flip side of that is here we are facing a crucial decision and we are greatly impaired. So the margins here are almost off the chart.
The margins are very thin, Bob. The passenger has already apparently passed out. The pilot has a multitude of hypoxia symptoms already. And that would lead you to believe that perhaps his judgment might already be impaired at a point when it's critical that he have a clear plan in mind to execute a recovery from this situation.
Right. And so let's just zero in on this poor guy and kind of ask, you know, how he got there. Because, you know, here he is. And if we kind of back up from where he is to maybe where he should have been, you know, we have the lessons that we really need to take away from this scenario. So here he is in an airplane at 16,000 feet. How close is he to passing out, literally becoming unconscious, becoming incapable of operating his airplane? Can we answer that question definitively?
This pilot was very close. As Bob mentioned, he's already displayed almost all the symptoms. So the chances at this point of him making a good decision, I think, are really slim. So even though he's still alive now, one bad decision is going to put him in serious trouble.
And if we look at the useful consciousness chart, he's already consumed the 30 minutes that is indicated on the chart for an altitude of 15,000 feet. And he's actually at 16,000.
So here he is, you know, just about out of options. How far back do we have to go just in this scenario where he had a lot more options? Because right now, you know, he really needs to do the right thing now, or we're talking a tragic mishap. Let's just back up in the scenario a little bit. He started feeling hypoxia. What do most general aviation pilots know about hypoxia? John, what do you?
Not much. And this is really a two-part thing. The first part is recognizing the symptoms, recognizing that you have an issue, and then what do you do about it, and how do you make that decision when you're functioning at far less than full capacity? And it takes full capacity to fly an airplane. So you need to go back and look at a couple of things, even back to the pre-flight. It was the oxygen system tested in the pre-flight? When was the last time it was serviced? We're relying on this one system to make this flight, and it's really no different than any other critical system. If you're relying on a de-icing system or anything else, you got to make sure that it works and you know how to do it. Because we are intentionally planning this flight through an area that requires it. Not a whole lot different than flying over a couple of hundred miles of open water in a single engine airplane. You know, you're placing all your faith in one system and the ability to carry out that flight. So that's a big piece of it. The other part would be the planning. Can you plan a route differently that would allow for lower MEAs, perhaps, maybe a detour? We don't really know in this case what the pilot's decision. Or is it, I bought all this stuff on the airplane, I'm going direct at the altitude I got.
That's why I bought this particular airplane.
Yeah, with this equipment.
But, you know, as pilots, we plan, we play what if all the time. Mm-hmm. What if my engine fails on takeoff? What if my engine fails here? What if I lose my vacuum system? I don't know if this pilot was playing what if I lose my oxygen system as part of his planning or not. But certainly, if you're relying on that system, just like you rely on your VORs and your vacuum system and your engine, you certainly should be thinking about as part of your pre-flight planning, what am I going to do if it doesn't work? If he had done that thinking prior, maybe the chances of him making a good decision now are better, would be better.
And truly, I mean, do we consciously think about how utterly dependent we are on this one system that probably works great, has always worked great for us, but when it doesn't work, it creates this absolute nightmare. And don't, you know, make any mistake about it. This is a real nightmare right here now because, you know, you are at the length of your rope, you're right at the end of your rope, and you're euphoric. You're thinking, hey, how good is life? And if you've never experienced that before, your chances of, you know, kind of waking up because, you know, you may smell the coffee, but it ain't there, you know? Right. And so it's a double-edged sword, and you're right at the tip of it.
And you bring up a good point about not having experienced it, Bob. And there are ways that you can experience it. The FAA does offer the high altitude training course, its status right now with budget cuts and things like that may be in question. But there are places that you can go and experience this and take the training, know what to do, know how to recognize it, know how your individual physiology differs from the textbook. Maybe you're better than the numbers, maybe you're worse than the numbers. But until you've actually experienced it and know how you will react, you're just guessing. You don't really know.
John, you just bring up a fantastic point, because here we are, you know, betting our life, you know, on our ability to operate in this potentially hostile environment. Well, 16,000 feet with oxygen, it's not hostile at all. Take away the oxygen, it is very, very hostile, and you've never been in that environment before, okay?
Nor are you required to receive any training in this.
No, and I've mentioned, you know, countless times, I know in these workshops, the Air Force put me in an aviation physiology class because they knew I had to have that information, and there would be a time in my aviation career when my life would depend upon it. Well, we don't require that of general aviation people. You know, that you read in the magazines all the time about how the government burdens, you know, the general aviation pilot with all these untold requirements. Well, this is one where we, you know, under-regulate rather than over-regulate, and it's an area that everybody needs to know. And you take, you know, the most conscientious pilot. I can read a book on this stuff. Does that make me an expert?
Not till you've experienced it.
There you go. You know, once again, we get in this, you know, not knowing what you don't know. And I've sat there in the oxygen chamber watching a room full of people around me, you know, going goofy.
Yeah.
You know, a room of rational people, and not one size does not fit all. You know, they always say, you know, let's watch. And you know, everybody in the room has a different, because of some of the factors Bob talked about, you know, your age, your weight, your health, your fitness, all that kind of stuff. Some people, you know, have twice the capacity of others, and nobody knows exactly where they are on that spectrum, but this guy's getting real close to passing out.
What's needed here really is a backup system, and it's not mandated by the regulations, and that being the pulse oximeter. That is a device which should be required, and it isn't required, but any pilot who has an airplane of this type can certainly afford to acquire a pulse oximeter. They're very cheap now. They clamp onto your finger. They're not really an inconvenience. And it gives you a real-time reading of what your blood oxygen level is. And if you see it going below 90%, there's problems somewhere.
Or actually below whatever your normal reading should be.
Right. And
that goes back to the old thing about if it doesn't look right, if it doesn't feel right,
it's probably not right.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you
had enough clues here that something was not right. Starting back with when you couldn't figure out how to program the GPS. Something wasn't right here, but you kept on going.
As we've said over and over and again in these workshops, with good information, we make good decisions.
Right.
Well, right now, you know, based upon, you know, the hypoxia, you are not getting the information you need to make a good decision.
Or you're not able to process it properly.
Exactly. With this device, you know, which is literally gives you everything you need to know to make a very, very conscious decision early while you still have capacity.
Right, before you've exhausted the 30 minutes that might be available to you before you start losing your ability to rationally deal with things, you'll see that your oxygen levels are going down. This is abnormal for me. I've got a problem here. Don't know what it is, but now's the time to take care of it.
And so, okay, that's one way to fix it. Another way to fix it is really, to the very best of your ability, make sure your equipment is working absolutely the way it's designed to be. And, you know, it gets back to pre-flight, you know, and troubleshooting your system. Well, we have our minimum requirements, you know, and it says you will check this system every certain number of months. Well, do you want a system that operates at the minimum standards, or do you want a system that operates at the optimal standards? Well, your call. Which way do you want to go on this?
If you're going to be up there where your life depends on it, I think we all know the answer to that.
Isn't that the truth? But pilots, you know, are traditionally cheap Charlies. You talk to the mechanics all the time. The guys will come in, hey, how cheaply can I get this done? What's the minimum I can do? It's expensive owning an airplane. We're not looking for ways to go out and spend money unless it's not a new audio system or headsets or something that, you know, is new and fancy. But the systems that we have on our airplane, knowing your airplane, you know, that's your life capsule.
And inspecting the system, and I'm thinking in terms of the masks, These airplanes that are equipped with the supplemental oxygen system, you'll typically find the mask stuffed in a pocket, all rolled up in a pocket. And it's a plastic mask with a plastic tube on it. It sits in the airplane year after year, being baked in 100 degree temperatures or 150 degree temperatures, probably in the summer. You need to look at that stuff and find out if it's still in a condition where it's serviceable, or whether the plastic is cracked or you have tubes that are cracking. Inspections on this stuff are essential to providing some guarantee that when you need the equipment, it'll function properly.
Bob, I think you recall from your days in the military, and I do from the airline, that every time we got in the airplane, we had a rather detailed check of the oxygen regulator and the mask system.
Absolutely. In our checklist.
And in the airplanes you fly, Bob, the same thing.
Part of the checklist is we ensure that oxygen is flowing to the mask. It's a very simple check, but it's got to be done because there are conditions. There might have been some maintenance done. We could see tank pressure on the gauge. That doesn't mean the oxygen is flowing to the mask. Typically in airplanes, the tank pressure gauge taps off at the tank. It doesn't tell you that you have pressure at the mask. Mm-hmm. So you really have to check the mask to be sure oxygen will flow.
Once again, you know, people, you know, lump everybody into one group, but it's easy to be lazy, you know, and then traditionally, well, we get there and we get into our airplane and we're a little bit late, we're a little bit behind. And can you skip that step? Yeah, I guess I can, you know. Would you skip that item on a check ride? You got a check airman? You would never think about that. Well, never. Okay, a check ride is one thing, but the reality is, why are you really checking this thing? Because it may save my life.
That's exactly right.
When we flew at high altitude in pressurized airplanes, that was absolutely a lifesaver, and we knew it. You wouldn't think about not checking it. Well, in general aviation airplanes, how often do you fly in an environment that requires oxygen? Not very often.
Right.
So you're not comfortable with it. You're not familiar with it. Like he said, you know, he put off wearing that mask as long as he could because it wasn't fun. He kind of set himself up for this, but the feedback was there. And as pilots, we need to be tuned into the feedback. We talked about it doesn't feel right. Well, the guy next to you has, you say, you know, the initial indication is fell asleep. But when he doesn't wake up, you know, guess what? He's not sleeping. He's passed out. And yet, you know, we, for whatever reason, ignored. Pretty darn good piece of feedback.
Well, it's getting back to the point where his judgment is impaired, and he was not interpreting that input, that the passenger was not responding to him.
That's right.
So, again, another input not being processed.
Then you got to also decide, okay, now we have this situation. How are we going to get out of it? How are we going to fix it? And do we even have a plan? Do we have an idea how we're going to fix this? Somehow, through the haze, we realize that we do have an issue. We've finally come to that point. How are we going to solve it? Do we have a plan? Do we have a bailout plan? What kind of resources do we have available to us at that point? When you went over the North Atlantic in a twin-engine jet, what was your bailout plan? You always had one on paper beforehand.
Yeah, we pre-planned it. And at this point, we went to A, and at the next point, we went to airport B. And we thought that through before we departed.
You knew how much fuel you needed to get to that airport. You knew what the weather was at that airport. You always had a bailout plan. And the plan was updated as you're moving along. But here we are at 16,000 feet droning along on autopilot, marveling at, have we looked around to see if I needed to go somewhere, what's the weather below me? What's the weather 100 miles south? What's 100 miles north? What's my plan? We don't even have one.
You've done some right things. I mean, you suspect that your oxygen, you have reason to believe that your oxygen system is not. I mean, you check the pressure, you check the flow meter. Yeah. You've done the right things, but you're not getting the right answer. Aren't we in aviation? You know, oh, it's always over the next hill. I mean, this is going to work out. You know, I'm going to find it. We're going to break out. You know, we pilots are, by nature, eternal optimists. It's always going to get better. Well, you have enough cues here that you really need to do something, and you need to do it now. So what are your choices? You know, you can speak up. And we've always said here, ATC is your friend. But then again, there's a natural reluctance on the part of pilots to come up and tell ATC, hey, I have a problem. Are those the words out of most pilots' mouth? Oh, I'm going to get in trouble. You might think, oh, I'll just cancel. Is this a good spot to cancel, Bob?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Let's go wandering around in the clouds with high
in
terrain
the
around.
Yeah.
But
the
is this not an option that has worked for you in previous scenarios? Is that part of your, you know, your history, your flying history?
It may have been. It may have been. This pilot may have done that previously in less hostile terrain, under less extreme circumstances, and gotten away with it.
If you asked ATC for lower altitude without saying what the issue is, just say, you know, center and need lower, well, unable due to the MEAs.
That would be your standard answer. Right.
Sure. Then, cancel. And that's the next response. But
your point earlier, John, is good. And that's why, you know, in so many of these scenarios, we talk about declaring an emergency. Get the help from ATC. This guy, he needed it because maybe they would say, that's not a good idea what you're going to do. Here's an idea. Think about this, or get him weather, or get him airport conditions, or whatever.
There's been a couple of these, actually. There was one recently with the Cirrus out in the West Coast, a very similar situation, an oxygen failure. And the pilot passed out. The non-flying spouse managed to talk to center. Another pilot on the frequency happened to be familiar with that particular airplane and was able to at least talk to the person on there. And what they did then was they talked the other person into how to program the autopilot to a lower altitude and get the airplane down. So that's another resource. There's a multitude of stuff out there that you could use. But you got to speak up.
You do. Boy, I'll tell you, the first words out of your mouth, yep. But not only the declaring the emergency, but letting the guy know immediately that you have an oxygen issue, because, you know, that's going to send additional bells and whistles, because, you know, the guy on the ground is going to say, hey, how much time does this guy have left because of all the issues we talked about. And as the scenario is set up, this guy has been experiencing a bunch of symptoms. He's got just about all of them, which leads me to believe that he's real close to his time of useful consciousness, and that's the end of the road. The airplane's flying itself at that point.
Until it runs out of fuel, and that's happened before.
We've seen it. Yeah, yep. The airplane just keeps on going, until it does. But the margins here are just so very tight, and based upon your knowledge or lack of knowledge of hypoxia, you just have very, very little capability. So doing something sooner rather than later is essential. I mean, I don't know how we can emphasize that strongly enough, or how we emphasize how important it is to people to understand this concept, the concept of hypoxia, and how it is. You talk about a slippery slope. I mean, it's like a canyon. I mean, it's not a slippery slope. You go right off the edge and you disappear into the deepest
abyss.
Pit. Yeah, the abyss is exactly right. So getting help now with ATC, with as much specificity as you can do, and you're not going to be inclined to do that because you're saying, hey, you know, life is good. And how do you explain that to somebody that's never been there before? How do we get pilots to read up on hypoxia and the symptoms of hypoxia and what it feels like to be, you know, oxygen deprived?
We just need to realize that if you choose to operate in this environment, Bob, the oxygen system and its functioning is just as important as the function of the oil system or the fuel system or any other systems on the airplane. That becomes another system that we have to be aware of and manage.
Bring as many tools as your tool bag will allow. And boy, the simple device that allows you to keep track of your oxygen level, boy, that's pretty cheap insurance.
And they're relatively cheap. Wally, you procured one of these things for minimal dollars.
$40 at Walmart.
Yes.
It may or may not be the most reliable one in town, but I compared it with more expensive ones, and it seemed to be working fine.
And you did this in flight at altitude.
Exactly. And by the way, I learned that my personal altitude maximum is about 11,500 feet. Mm-hmm. Even though the regulations would allow me to go higher, I start going below 90% at that altitude.
You know, listening to our bodies is something, you know, some people do it, some people don't, but it's, you look at world-class athletes, how many years ago when they had the Olympics at Mexico City, and world-class athletes were being challenged, you know, to the max, just because it is just, it's a physical limitation that you can't ignore. You can try to ignore it, but it's going to win. I mean, it will take its toll, and you're going to pay, you're going to ultimately pay the piper.